Right. So, on to a wee bit about stars. I'm quite happy just to leave the lights up, Joe, if that's all right. Because, you know, I think you'll be able to see the images all right. And it's much nicer if I can see all you as well. So I just wanted to talk a wee bit about stellar life and death. This isn't, of course, you know, completely new, I would expect, to any of you, because when I've been at shows, you know, I hear people talk about the colours of stars and the fact that you have old stars and young stars and so on. But I just wanted to give you a few pointers of the kind of state of the art, if you like. State of the art when the Science Centre opened would probably have been an image like this one. This was taken with the Hubble Space Telescope, and it's of something called the Eagle Nebula. And this is a big pillar of gas that's got newly born stars inside, and those stars are illuminating the gas from within. And, well, that we think is a good archetype for how stars form, that it's all about gravity and pressure. And we see lots of examples of that. I'll just elaborate on that in just a minute. But just some more nice pictures first. This is the Orion Nebula. So if you were going to talk about star birth and star death, and some of you do this already, I'm sure, then the Orion Nebula is a good place to start because, you know, it looks pretty good in the planetarium. Deep inside the Orion Nebula, a sword of Orion, are gas clouds where we think there are new star systems being born all the time. But we don't just think that, we can see them. And how does that all come about? Well, it's a balance between pressure and gravity. Stars are big balls of gas. Gas, when it's heated, exerts an outward pressure. And that outward pressure is what keeps the star from collapsing, because gravity wants to make it collapse. It wants to pull the star all together to make it smaller and smaller. But it can't, because the gas pressure is pushing against it and balancing. So stars are doing a bit of a balancing act between pressure and gravity. Okay, so if you want to make a star, what you do is take a big cloud of gas like you've got in the Orion Nebula, and gravity will want to make that gas cloud collapse. Eventually it'll get hot enough that the gas pressure will push out against it, and when they balance, you've got yourself a star. Okay? Remember John Brown, Astronomer Royal at Glasgow, who, you know, was my sort of mentor when I was starting off as a student. He, you know, does stuff with the Science Centre still. To a great extent, he used to have a cartoon on his office door, and it was a big cloud of gas, and there was a bubble coming out the side saying, "I may just be a big cloud of gas, but someday I'm going to be a star," which I thought was quite nice. So stars come not so much in different shapes, they're all basically round, but they do come in different sizes, and those sizes reflect their different temperatures, and there's different ways that astronomers classify them. But the traditional way is via what's called the spectral sequence, and this goes back to the, you know, early 1900s and 1800s, when astronomers really were doing stamp collecting, frankly. They were just making big catalogues of all the stars they could see. So there's various mnemonics have been made up. Old blind astronomers from Glasgow, Keep Mice is one of my favourites. And from time to time we run a competition with the undergraduates to see who can come up with the best one, and most of them are unprintable. So you wouldn't be able to use them here. But the really hot stars are blue. The really cool stars are red. The sun's kind of in the middle. The surface temperature of the sun's about 6,000 degrees. But the temperature deep inside the sun is many millions of degrees. So the big blue stars are using up their hydrogen, because stars are just big balls of hydrogen, very fast. The red stars are using up their hydrogen very, very slowly. So the blue stars sort of don't last for very long. The red stars last for a very long time indeed. And all the time, whatever the temperature of the star, what's really going on deep in the centre is that they're turning hydrogen into helium. And if you want some numbers, because, you know, a lot of kids are really impressed by numbers, then every second, 600 million tonnes of hydrogen are turned into 596 million tonnes of helium in the sun. Now that leaves 4 million tonnes left over, and that's turned into energy, according to Mr. Einstein's famous E equals mc squared. So, since the speed of light's a big number, E equals mc squared says that for a given amount of mass, you get a lot of energy, and here you're talking 4 million tonnes every second, so that's a heck of a lot of energy. And that is what is powering the sun. The sun has got enough hydrogen to keep doing that for about 10,000 million years, and it's actually about halfway through. So it's got another 5,000 million years or so left before it runs out of hydrogen in its core. Now what will happen then? Well, the details are a bit complicated. I didn't want to go into all of that, but those of you who are doing the introductory course for the OU will probably be learning about some of that anyway, and indeed some of the background notes that I'm putting together for the high school, for the advanced higher, cover all of that. So I'll make sure that you get copies of those just so you can gen up on it if you want to. But essentially it goes like this. Hydrogen gets turned into helium, but when the hydrogen in the core has all been turned into helium, then what happens is that heavier elements start to get made. But in order for that to be possible, the core's got to shrink and get even hotter, because you need higher temperatures to make helium turn into lithium or beryllium or whatever else. So the core gets hotter, and to balance that, the outer part of the star gets cooler. And it means that an orangey, yellowy star like the Sun, when it reaches that stage in its life, will turn into a red giant. So the core of the Sun will get hotter so that it can start making heavier elements, but meanwhile the outer part of the Sun will get so big that there's a very good chance it will swallow up the Earth. So I'm sure you get lots of questions about how the Earth's going to get swallowed up by stars and so on, or how we're going to get hit by asteroids or all the other ways the universe can kill us. But this one really will happen, but not for several billion years. So if you want the details, I'll pass those on by way of just giving you a sort of resource bank you can tap into if you wish. I've done it again. I have a thing about gravitational waves. Right button this time. This is an example of what's called a planetary nebula. They're very beautiful. They're nothing to do with planets. It's just that when they were first observed through telescopes, you know, of order 100 years ago or more, then people thought they looked a bit like planets because we didn't have as good a view of them as you get now. This is a Hubble telescope image. And in the centre is the left behind core of a red giant star. We call that a white dwarf. And then the outer part that looked as if it was swallowing up the Earth in the previous slide just spreads out rather sedately through the universe. And it's the ultimate cosmic chemical recycling project. Again, I'm sure many of you will know some of this or talk about it already, that those chemical elements that are made inside stars eventually find their way into new planetary systems. So we are all made out of star stuff, recycled material from earlier generations of stars. If you start off with a star that's more massive than the Sun, then you don't just make the light stuff like helium all the way up to carbon and oxygen, but you can make heavier elements too, like the metals, magnesium, all the way up to iron, silicon, sulfur and so on. Iron is kind of where it stops. Now the reasons for that are quite technical, but it's all to do with what we call the binding energy of the nucleus. But there are ways to make heavier elements than iron, but what you've got to do if you want that to happen is make the star blow up. And fortunately nature provides such a mechanism, because what happens is you have a supernova explosion. The way it works is this: the gas pressure is sustaining the inner part of the star, but once there isn't any outward gas pressure anymore, gravity's just going to win the battle and it's going to make the star collapse. And in fact, what will happen is that in a very short time, like, you know, a fraction of a second, the star will explode. This is what we call a supernova, or more technically a core collapse supernova. And there are numerous such examples. This one is called the Crab Nebula, and it's the remnant — that's a real image now, the rest of course was a simulation — it's the remnant of an explosion that happened in the year 1054. It was observed by Chinese astronomers, and it's in the constellation of Taurus, up close to the horns of the bull. So again, that's one you can actually show people. And you don't really see a star at all unless you've got a pretty powerful telescope. If you've got a powerful telescope like the Hubble telescope, then this is what you see. This is the expanding shell of material from the supernova. It's now many light years across, so it was going at a fair old lick when it exploded. And deep in the heart of the Crab Nebula is something that's completely weird. It's the core of the massive star left behind. It's called a neutron star. It's like so incredibly dense that even a thimbleful of it would weigh billions of tons. And it's about 10 kilometres across, about the size of Glasgow, but it's more massive than the Sun. And it's spinning really fast. It spins about 33 times a second. And it was discovered by very eminent astronomer Jocelyn Bell, who studied at Glasgow, but she'd already moved on to do a PhD in Cambridge when she made the discovery, 1967. In fact, I've got a picture of her from 67, which isn't terribly flattering. She's a very nice woman, you know, and has aged very gracefully. You know, she's, you know, I'm not sure what age she is now, but she certainly doesn't, you know, doesn't look her age. But actually, her 1967 picture, you know, as many did from that era, does look a wee bit sort of dated. And I remember showing it to some of our students and just wondering if anyone knew. And I said, you know, she was wearing these old sort of NHS prescription glasses. And I said, does anyone know what this woman discovered in 1967? And one of the students said, contact lenses, which was very unfair. But nonetheless, the interesting part of the story was that as a student in 1967, when she made the discovery, she subsequently didn't get the Nobel Prize for discovering these things called pulsars, neutron stars, pulsating neutron stars. Her supervisor got the prize. And she's been very okay about it. She said that actually she's won loads more prizes because everyone feels that they've got to make it up to her for not having won the Nobel Prize. But I personally think she was really hard done by and should have got the credit. She observed it with a radio telescope. She was using a radio telescope down in Cambridge. And if we've got time, one of my five themes was to look at the kind of the wider spectrum, the fact that we actually do astronomy not just with light anymore, but with all forms of electromagnetic radiation. So I'll come back to that. So that was kind of about all I wanted to say about stars. Just to mention that there's various other supernova remnants, which are quite spectacular, but again, you need a very big telescope to see them. Sooner or later, there's going to be a supernova in our galaxy again. I mean, we expect one roughly every 50 years or so. Hasn't been one for a long time. You don't want a supernova to go off too close to us because it really could wreak havoc. But fortunately, there aren't really any big, massive stars close enough to us that, you know, we need to be worried. See, I'd be much more worried about the asteroids hitting us. So if it's a really, really massive star to begin with, you don't even get a neutron star. What you get is a black hole. And I'll say a bit more about black holes a wee bit later, if time allows. But your good analogy for the black hole is the gravity well that you've got outside. You know, the idea that it bends space so much, the gravity of a black hole, that even light can't escape. And do black holes exist? Well, in terms of black holes that are stars, we've got pretty good evidence going back to when I was a kid. And this is an artist's impression of an object called Cygnus X1. So constellation of Cygnus is one of the ones that's very easy to spot in the planetarium. And this is a blue supergiant star with a massive companion. And we don't really know for sure that's a black hole, but we can work out the mass of this thing from the way that it's orbiting the blue supergiant. And that's just like how we do it for exoplanets. It's gravity again. The, you know, think of the seesaw. And our thinking is that this thing is so massive that if it isn't a black hole, well, must be something even weirder. So our best guess is that it's a black hole. And we call it Cygnus X1 because it's giving off X-rays. And that's because it's very hot. Well, the black hole itself doesn't let any light escape, but as the material is pulled off the companion, it gets heated up and accelerated, and that gives off X-rays. Again, I'll come back to the whole idea of radio through to X-rays and gamma rays a wee bit later. Okay? So just to finish up on stars, just to emphasise, if you look at the whole periodic table, then hydrogen and helium, we think, was around really since the Big Bang, but pretty much all the other elements were made inside stars. That's an astronomer's periodic table would say, you know, first two Big Bang, everything else made inside stars. And that includes iron brew. Yeah. So all the iron in iron brew didn't come from girders, as the advert used to say, but it came, well, maybe it did come from girders, but the girders originally came from supernovae. That might not have been quite such a catchy advertising campaign. Okay, so see, I'm throwing a lot of stuff at you, I know, but it was just by way of stimulating some head scratching and some thinking. I've certainly been in here and heard a number of you develop this theme a wee bit about stars and young stars and old stars and so on, so I'm hoping some of this was already fairly familiar, but that's kind of, you know, a potted history of stellar evolution in 10 minutes. So any questions about stars or comments or suggestions for how you might use it?